Well, we're listening to some snow as we watch the snow. This piece is called Snowfall from the Ahmad Jamal Trio. Don't forget Fourth Branch Jazz, live jazz from the studio with pretty much a different jazz person each week. Tonight, Mort will be in, I believe. Snow should stop probably by 7 o'clock. Beautiful piece here from the Ahmad Jamal Trio. Hey, this is Greenzine, by the way, as we enjoy the snowfall. Maybe you can get outside immediately after the show and enjoy the snow. Henry is in touch with our guest right now who's going to call in. She was originally going to come in, but the driving, maybe not so great unless you really needed to get out there and drive. I will tell you, though, that Greenzine is brought to you each week here on WFVR-LP South Royalton by the White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit, Solar Fest, the First Branch Coffee Company, Upper Pass Beer Company, Soloflect, Bale, Royal Trailworks, and Daniel Leibowitz. Well, we're going to get Bird Note lined up for you here in just a moment. But I want to touch on today's White River Valley Herald. They have a column that is taken from the Northern Woodlands Quarterly magazine, which I get at home. And you may be interested in checking out, published over in Lyme. And okay, so we're going to go on with this. Northeastern hawks soar through winter. This is written by Susan Shea. Driving on Vermont's interstate highways in winter, I often notice large hawks perched in trees on woodland edges at regular intervals along the road, with the stark landscape providing better visibility and many bird species gone for the winter. This is a great time of year to hawk watch. Yeah, there's something to do. The raptor I see most along the highway has a white breast with a band of dark brown streaks across the belly, a brown back, and a reddish tail. This is a red-tailed hawk, North America's most common hawk. Some species of hawks that breed in northern New England migrate south for the winter, but most red-tailed hawks remain and are joined by others of their kind from Canada. I frequently see red-tailed hawks soaring above open areas. They turn slow circles on broad, rounded wings with their tail feathers fanned out and occasionally emit a piercing career, K-R-E-E-R. Henry, are you ready to join me there? Probably not. He's going to finish up the whole phone call off the air as I chide him a little bit. And there you are, Henry. Now you're going to join me. I'm going to turn you up.
Yeah, I've come back to my normal microphone.
Yeah. So I could scold you, but I won't do that on the air. I thought that was going to be a really quick phone call, and she was going to call back in a little bit. But you guys started.
She is going to do that, yeah. But she was talking about what we might want to talk about.
Yeah, more, that's good.
More
that's,
depth.
That's
so
pretty important, so that we're not clueless when the phone rings. So Henry Swayze live in the studio unexpectedly, but that's good. He's making sure that his house is, I don't know if it's winterized, but at least that it won't freeze and get covered completely with snow, right?
It's been a cold patch, and I came down a little over a week ago to check on it and found that the plants in the house had a few freezer burns that were near windows, but the house was at about 42.
Oh, that's fine.
Which is fine, except none of the water was frozen anywhere, and so I didn't have my water in, didn't have my wood in the house to speak of. So I built a couple of fires and left again. So it was a quick round trip to make sure that I didn't have to stay there. And now I was coming back to try to actually fill up the wood bins and get things so that the house is really up to temperature before I leave again this time.
Yeah. Now, is that wood dry, Henry?
The wood is very dry,
okay.
And now most of it's 2 years old, and even the stuff that I never ranked stays really dry because it's a sunny exposure with a lot of wind. And the stuff that's on the ground at the bottom of the pile it burns pretty well, but it does carry a lot of moisture. But the rest of the pile, anything that's not actually in contact with the ground, is just as dry as the stuff I ranked.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit more about wood piles and burning with wood. So what do you think is the primary species in your wood pile of trees?
There is a lot of ash because a lot of it has come from foresters taking out ash before
the emerald ash borer.
Yep. Finishes them off. And ash is a lovely wood in that even if you have fairly freshly cut ash, it dries out faster and burns more readily. You take something like elm, and it's the opposite. You have to dry it forever.
Yeah. And a fairly good BTU level with ash, too.
Yeah, it's not quite up there with
oak.
Or maple.
Or
oak, but it's close.
Yeah, it's close.
And my daughter's out in the Pacific Northwest, and they don't have much hardwood. They have a madrona is the only real hardwood tree.
I haven't heard
around.
Of that one.
Yeah. And it burns nicely, good firewood. But they burn an awful lot of softwoods. And it's amazing. They do pretty well. I wouldn't turn your nose up at a tree that needs getting out of the way.
Yeah, we have a little bit of poplar that we're mixing in, and it burns. I guess though that if you're burning a lot of softwoods, you just really got to keep it going because the heat and the BTU content is lower in those. And then I'd be a little concerned. Isn't there maybe more of a creosote buildup with burning a lot of softwood?
Well, I think if you do softwood, anything, you damp the stove down, and you're creating some of a creosote. Buildup.
Okay.
And I think softwood is worse, and wet softwood is worse than that.
So we're staying away from the worst stuff. We had to take an ash tree that had been pretty old ash tree, but it had been cabled together, and it was one of the tentacles coming off. It was probably going to let loose and come down on a car or over the driveway. And I'll tell you, when that got bucked up and we blocked it and then split it and let it dry for a while, that really, the winter of 23-24 was mostly warmed by that ash. So that was one of the benefits of that coming down. And, you know, there are some people that are deliberately leaving a few ash trees up, hoping that some of them will make it through and maybe strengthen that species of wood, and maybe we won't lose every ash tree in the area.
That's what happened to Dutch elm, and selective of the ones that survived has bred virus-resistant elm.
Yeah. Yeah, and another tree that's pretty prevalent around here that is coming down on its own because of a different disease is the beech trees. They get that canker sore all over them, and they die and drop down. Yeah.
So this winter, that canker is killed by under 10 degree temperatures without snow cover, because the snow cover keeps the base of the tree
insulated,
cankerized. and so there may be some reversal, because we've had some pretty darn cold weather without much snow cover here.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like what's going on with the government right now. Cankerized.
Cankerized.
Yeah, it could be cankerized.
I think
it's
a good thing to have some humor in this day.
We do need to have that. Well, Henry, I was just talking about some hawks that are still in the area in the winter, but we have dialed up bird note. We might talk about your charger issue out there later in the show. And Robin Sherman, Lauren Sherman.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about her. She'll be checking in just a few minutes.
So I know Lauren from being on the board of the Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition, and she is an environmentalist. I believe went to the law school. She is actually shopping for jobs right now and trying to figure out what job you take that might not get pulled out from under you. And I had dinner with Hank Joseph in Tunbridge, and his daughter is in the same boat, trying to decide what job to take and whether an environmental job and whether there's any point or whether she ought to just do something highly personal, like go to sea on a sailboat or something instead. And I think she's going to take one of the environmental jobs that might go away. And if it goes away, then she'll go out to sea on a boat.
Wow.
She is a full-fledged sea captain that can allowed to take out, I don't know, 150-ton boats, big things. So she's she has a backup profession that she can turn into an income. So
there's another thing
that I heard this morning on public radio, and I went and researched it, and I will attempt to put it in the notes after the show. Tonight, at, I believe, 8 o'clock, there is a program on sound and its impact on humans, and I believe a little bit of its impact on nature. And perhaps, I don't know, 6 years ago, we actually interviewed someone from the Pacific Northwest who was a sound engineer all of his life and recorded a lot of wild sound. And he started a group, One Square Foot of Silence, and was trying to eliminate all jet noise. He had targeted the Ho National Wilderness on the Olympic Peninsula because that's already a protected area. But the Navy, or I don't know, some military jets fly over there. And he said, I bet that they could move 10 miles away and not have to fly right over that. And it's interesting when you, he said when back in the 1960s and 70s, he said he could do a recording of a train coming or of anything in nature. He would record a lot of things and then sell them to things like tracks for movies and things like that. And he said it used to be that it was really easy to get a clean soundbite of something in nature. And he said now he rarely can get more than 3 minutes without having background. Intervening sign.
Yeah, there's some sort of human-caused sound, a plane going over, cars on a highway. That's interesting. Hey, I want to stand corrected on, we were talking about various types of firewood, and I said poplar. We do not burn poplar at all. We have some around, but that is not a good idea. So just take that off the list of possible firewoods. But most people that are burning wood probably know that. Well, Henry, should we dive into a bird note here?
I just want to say as a counter to that, I burn poplar, not only poplar, but it does burn.
Okay. All right.
It's sort of like it is a deciduous tree, which makes it into a hardwood, but it behaves more like a softwood.
Okay. Well, if we have some that falls down in our woods, we'll call you to come take it away. in your busy schedule. Yeah. All right. So Henry's plugged in, and we've got bird mode. And the one we're going to play today, which is the most recent one, is titled Bohemian Waxwings Wander South. You're tuned to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. We'll be right back with you.
This is bird mode. In winter, when snow blankets the northern states, nearly all of the beautiful songbirds that grace the days of summer are long gone. They're living out the cold months in warmer climes. But there's one special winter visitor that goes a long way to filling the absence left by the birds of summer. Picture a starling-sized bird with a swanky crest, a black mask, wings painted in red, yellow, black, and white, and a tail boldly tipped with yellow. This glamorous winter visitor is the Bohemian Waxwing. When Bohemian waxwings appear on the scene, they arrive in flocks, often numbering in the hundreds. They roam the landscape in search of winter fruits, berries of mountain ash or juniper, rose hips, even unpicked apples. In autumn, departing their summer haunts in the boreal forest, waxwings wander south into the northern states and along the Rockies. Some years they venture even farther south. In fact, it's this itinerant life that earned them the name Bohemian, although the name seems equally well suited to their unconventional and exquisite appearance. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, thank you, Michael. Bird Note, we air that each week here on Green Zine. Yeah. Have you seen any Bohemian waxwings in the last few months, Henry?
I haven't. They don't come to the feeder in Burlington. I was walking along the Winooski River. A frequent walk down from Jane's house gives me a couple hundred feet of elevation to do and get my blood pressure up, get my heart rate up. There is a group of resident birds that are down there, and they're mostly mallard ducks and Canada geese. And this cold snap has made it so that the pocket of water that they are in, and there were 35 mallards, and there were three Canada geese. One, a mate died of one of those. I wondered if that was bird flu, but the rest of them haven't succumbed. And I was wondering, how do they get their food? And they were in that open patch of water and some up on the ice, and I watched them. And the mallards were flushing water through their mouth. They usually eat plant material, but never would have been enough plant material. But they were flushing water through their mouth, and I guess sieving out little fine bits of nutrient that is in the water. I wasn't close enough. I didn't pull a water sample and look at it and see what was in there. But they're making a living on it. It was just amazing. I figured that was. Wondered what would happen to them with more cold weather and that little patch of open water closing in. But much like the Bohemian waxwings, birds, when the food supply gets scarce, they migrate further south, get pushed further south even during the winter.
Yeah, you know, speaking of birds, and we'll be having our guest on here shortly, there's an area when I go home up the hill to over to Tunbridge, South Tunbridge, where they have chickens and guinea fowl and geese. And is there something else there? Four types of... anyway, the geese, even on some really cold days, directly across the road is a little rivulet that runs year-round, that it's moving enough that doesn't freeze. And they'll go over there. Oh, they do have some ducks as well. And they'll paddle around in there and have the best time. And I'm thinking, wow, how can they do that when it's 4 degrees outside? And they're definitely looking for that water. I call that area, and they might want to put up a caution sign. I call it foul crossing.
Foul crossing.
And all types of foul will cross right there. Yep.
Yeah. All right. That reminds me of being in England and coming to a place where there was water crossing the road. And apparently it always crossed the road, and it had a sign up. It was called Duckworthy Splash.
Duckworthy Splash. Wow, I like that.
That was a classic name for it.
I'm going to start pushing buttons here, Henry, and if things have lined up properly, I think we're going to be welcoming our guest to the air here on Green Zine. Go ahead, Henry.
Hi, Lauren. Is that you?
Yeah, it's me. Hi, Henry.
I'm glad we didn't have a telephone advertiser, because we just put you right on the air.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, we tried to do that the other day with a guest on a different show, and some buttons were kind of mixed up and everything. But we got them on. But we got you on pretty quick. Hey, welcome back. I'm trying to remember the time that you were with us before. When was that?
Well, were you?
I think it's been maybe a year.
Okay.
I don't know. It's been a while. last time you guys asked me good questions, and it kept me on my toes. And
oh, okay. Well, hopefully,
I like that about you. You're always up for a challenge, swimming in the deep end of the pool.
I do like swimming in the deep end. And yeah, thank you guys so, for reporting on all this stuff.
So we've not been talking about and commiserating about the unarming of the government and all of the let's make it good for big oil and forget about anything else that's going on in D.C. But it certainly is a depressing time. And you were telling me that you were trying to figure out what kind of job you should take. And if it was an environmental one, what do you do about the government's dismembering anything that's environmental? And I had dinner with someone last night who also has just been through an environmental school, Columbia, and is trying to decide. She had two or three job offers, and she was trying to figure out the exact same thing. Which way do you jump? Do you do what you think is really the best, the most important one, or do you take something that might not disappear in a month or 2 months?
Yeah, it's a big question. I mean, it's exactly the conundrum I'm in, trying to figure out, do you do something important that might disappear or try to find some stability, because what they're doing is pretty destabilizing. So,
And my sense is that it's intentionally destabilizing. I think that the courts will push back, and maybe even some of the Republicans in Congress will push back when it really gets on home territory for them. But in the meantime, they can scare and destabilize everything get us to be paralyzed, deer in the headlights.
Yeah, I mean, the way that this conversation had come about was in response to USDA's wiping of climate information. And so as I was preparing for it, I was thinking this morning about all the legal chaos, and it is legal chaos. And so in the midst of that, one of the things that I was thinking about was I was retracing last week, because things are rolling in so quickly. You know, what was even the order of the instructions that came in? And I realized the USDA instructions to wipe the climate information came in on Friday. It got reported out concurrently with the time that employees were supposed to be done submitting a spreadsheet saying, you know, tier one, tier two, tier three of different kinds of climate information that could get wiped. That came in, we heard about it Friday evening, and they were supposed to be completing it Friday evening. But the executive order that it was issued, that the instructions were issued under, had already been rescinded 2 days earlier. So I didn't even realize that on Friday. I didn't realize it until this morning that, you know, probably the instructions came back, came to the instructions to comply. By the time the deadline was, the order had already been rescinded federally, but I'm not even sure how many people realized that. So one of the things that I wanted to point out was, you know, for people who are caught in these situations, A powerful question is this legal to comply with? I would, and so you can ask that, and the sort of, there's sort of like a couple of relevant questions. One is, where is the money that was funding? Where did the money that funded this come from?
Yeah.
What was the original mandate? So, you know, if you have climate data and you're asked to wipe it, you know, was this funded by the Inflation Reduction Act, or was this fund, how was it funded, and where did the legislation come from? And for the original piece, and then which executive order are the instructions coming from, because the executive orders are also getting rescinded and put on hold by different judges. And so is it legal is a powerful question, and it takes a little bit of kind of figuring out, but I think before everyone complies, it's a useful thing to be asking.
That's really good insight. And just for a little background for our listeners, give me an idea of the implications of removing any climate data from its data they're removing. It isn't programs or something. It's they're asking to rewrite the history of science. Give us a little bit of background on just how, I don't know.
Well, what would the effects of removing that information, and also how is that data, when it is kept and it is available to scientists, how is it used to maybe influence policy going forward?
Yeah, I mean, the implications are pretty extreme. Climate's really important for producers. It's also important for states. If we have an orange crop or any kind of tree product that might be affected, you know, if the flowers are affected by changing pollination patterns or heat, it's important to know that. And it's significant not only for producers, but also for states and for food production and both domestically and for export. So the consequences of not knowing are enormous. The research is very important. And so far, what we've seen is a request to basically remove everything. So there's a request, there are requests for data, there's requests for removing studies. They basically, there's requests for removing websites for communicating the information to the public. And they have this morning at NOAA just tried to block any employees from even contacting climate scientists in other regions, which is impossible because climate knows no borders, and we need international information to have accurate predictions. So they're basically trying to wipe out everything. Most of the orders are not legal, and it will take time for the courts to process all of that. I mean, so I think it's pretty safe to assume that there are major legal complications in being asked to remove information. This is, the oil companies paid a lot for these elected representatives, and what they're getting is legal chaos asking to remove everything and data, studies in progress, completed studies and websites that are communicating to the public those basic findings.
So who pays for that legal pushback? And is that something that the general public has to put a shoulder to and help fund organizations to shut down the illegal activity that executive orders are seem to totally ignore?
Yep. I mean, it's going to be us. The funding comes in myriad forms. So there's government grant funding, there's NGO funding, there are partnership funds, between NGOs and the government. Funding also comes from donors. I know you donate to different organizations, and also for some of the legal organizations, some funding comes from recycling attorneys' fees from different cases. And the administration has also basically gone after every source of funding for the defense of this stuff. So they're also attacking nonprofit status and funding. They're unilaterally trying to shut down all the government funding, which the president doesn't have authority to do. Spending power rests with Congress, and so the president doesn't have unilateral power to do that, but they're trying to override that anyway. And then there are model, it hasn't rolled out yet at the federal level this year, but there have been state level tests run over the past few years for how to essentially cancel the attorney's fees model for the defense of these things. So the legal organizations and the NGOs are pretty much facing very critical attacks from all angles as they're trying to defend this. So support from the public is super important. But yeah, the public is going to bear the cost of the legal defense of the information that we need to grow and produce food. It's also going to bear the cost of, you know, the consequences of all of this. So if we don't have all this information and if we're unprepared down the line and get got by climate events, you know, we're also going to bear that cost down the line as well. So it's important that people push back now. I don't think we can really afford to just try to wait it out and solve it later.
And what would that form take? I'm thinking about our congressional delegation, who are probably all opposed to the actions being taken by the current administration. But is that the spot to go? You contact Senator Welch or Sanders or Representative Bailent, or are you going through the contacting the state government to try to ensure that environmental policies and information is kept kept safe here in Vermont? What do you recommend to do? What, you know, public outcry about this? Letters to the editor? What do you think?
I think all of the above are useful.
Okay.
You know, we need reporting on it, and it's certainly important to let, you know, your newspapers know that you want to know about this stuff, and to protect the journalists who are trying to get this information out, because there's a lot of pressure on the journalists as well. Welch, Sanders, and Bailent are, you know, excellent and yes, surely opposed to what is happening. And it's helpful for them to hear from their constituents. I would say any lever that you have the power to access, you know, go ahead and try. There's going to be public protests. There's going to be, And there's also going to be a lot of grunt work, you know, just happening quietly. So I would just say, you know, you can talk to different people wherever you have your access points, and you know, make a plan for how to resist it. I do think pulling some of the information, you know, there's a lot of efforts to archive existing information, and those are really helpful. And, you know, there may be some efforts to pull climate data and research into state-level archives. You know, you can talk to your libraries. You could talk to your state officials for that kind of thing. But, yeah, I mean, the federal structure exists for a reason. It's useful. And I think, you know, the idea that we can just cancel it all is pretty misguided. So I do see at the federal level that when people are pushing back, the administration also steps back. And so
there's,
you know,
a note of hope.
Yeah. You know, just know that they can't, you know, they're taking away so much, and creating so much chaos, they also can't handle how much chaos they're creating. So, you know, let them know. And I just think it's useful kind of across the board to push back.
I'm curious about, you know, trying to protect the data, or maybe even a sort of outsource it, or like you said, maybe libraries could help in this. So is that data that they're attempting to wipe, is that considered classified federal information, or can the public actually go to that now if they were doing some research?
Oh, climate data is very public for the most part. I mean, there is private data, but there's a lot of open access science. And, you can the Internet Archive, they are also going at, they have been going after the Internet Archive, but the Wayback Machine and the Internet Archive are kind of the top, well, they're the same thing, but you can get a browser extension and visit those pages and save screenshots of those pages, which a lot of people have been doing, and we did that during the last Trump administration. So that's one useful place to do it. I save a lot of, like, I go to open access climate science that's useful for me and my community, and I just save that stuff on my own. And the data itself, probably people in the communities who know how to use the data are going to have to save that stuff. But yeah, I mean, the Wayback Machine and the Internet Archive, if you look that up, that's easy for anybody to access. You can just add a browser extension and save PDFs.
So do you think that the government has the ability of actually removing data from the Wayback Machine, from the earlier versions of the what was available online?
I mean, they did take it down for a while, but it's back online. They, you know, they're this time, last Trump administration, you know, we archived a lot of stuff, and you know, just people everywhere archived a lot of stuff. This time they knew to come after it right away. So they are coming after the archives too. It's a full assault on publicly held scientific knowledge. They essentially want to erase it. So, I think it's useful to save it in the archives and hope for the best. And defend the archive itself. The archive itself is going to need defending as well. Yeah.
Wow. So we've got to ask questions. You've got to say, okay, how do we defend this? And let's be sure that we let our voice be known that it is defended. Or if not voice, again, you know,
yeah,
consider a half of 1% of your income. Maybe it's time to support things that you think could actually help out. That's the way I look at it.
You know, we just, in circumstances like these, it's just going to have to be, I think it's important for people to know that courage, you know, even as an attorney, like I it's kind of scary to face all this stuff and certainly it's scary for federal employees. And people are just going to have to just choose to carry on with courage and consider, you know, this assault on climate information, the number of ways that it's illegal is like impossible to count at this point. So, you know, this is fundamentally protecting constitutional rights, rights to speech, rights to, I even think we have unarticulated rights, like a right to knowledge that, you know, maybe isn't part of the constitutional framework at this point, but probably should be. So, you know, this is something that all the public and is going to have to be involved in and, you know, consider it an honor to stand up at a point when, you know, constitutional rights are being threatened and take some kind of small role in helping protect what we can.
Yeah.
And helping rebuild when this is, you know, when this storm passes too, because it's going to, this is probably a 10 or 20, I mean, this is going to be a 20-year rebuilding at least. I mean, this is, the legal chaos is not going to resolve anytime soon at all. It's going to be constant long-term defense of very fundamental rights that are under attack. Yeah.
The Trump playbook seems to be, well, if there's something that I want to do that's against the law, I'll just do it and then drag it out in the courts long enough so that everyone else withers and goes away and gives up on holding me accountable.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're counting on. And so I think people should know that they have a very reasonable ask here, which is, you know, we paid for this data. The government paid for you know, our tax dollars paid for this information on ecology and climate information. We should have access to it permanently. We want that access. We want the administration to behave legally. And so, you know, the Trump's team may be doing this, but that's still not an excuse for other politicians to take their cue from him. You know, elected representatives like Welch, Sanders, and Bielan are going to stand firm, I'm sure, and do their best. But, you know, making sure that we're behind them as they try to do that is going to be helpful. It's just going to take a lot of courage from a lot of different people. And I think some of these orders, you know, I was reading about how these orders had come to USDA, and it was, you know, some guy with a job within USDA who complied after the order had already been rescinded. And it would have been nice if he had asked, you know, his bosses, is this legal, before sending that out to the whole agency to start pulling down these websites. So, yeah, the information is quite chaotic. Just, you know, it's helpful to know or to ask, is this legal? What funded it originally and under what mandate? And then and what mandate is this instruction coming from, and have it is it still valid? Because we are seeing pretty quick judicial turnaround times on, you know, saying these executive orders are clearly illegal. You know, and they get rescinded, but people are still carrying out the instructions that have been issued. So,
well, it seems like such an Orwellian world, which has been here before, and not just with the current administration, where you would think on the administration, well, the executive and legislative, all three branches of government, that normally there is a certain level of trust that if something's coming down from a higher up, that it's most likely it is constitutional, it is legal, and therefore, but now there's such skepticism and distrust that it's almost if you're functioning in the federal government, that you immediately, an alarm should go off and say, wait, we need to really vet all of this before taking action, because it seems like you say, on a daily basis, things are coming out that are at minimal confusing, at a maximal either illegal or unconstitutional, and that's going to be quite a pushback. And the longer this goes on during this 4-year administration, without significant pushback, that rebuilding time that you referenced, Lauren, just gets stretched out even longer after these 4 years.
Yeah,
I mean, we're gonna be having conversations about how to update the Constitution, because this is stretching the Constitution so far, and it's important for people to know that, like, one of the main powers that the executive branch is overreaching right now is the power of the purse. So the power of the purse constitutionally rests in Congress, and the president is supposed to execute on that. And the president does have some discretion to, you know, instruct the agencies, but they can't. It's not constitutional to try to cancel congressionally appropriated funds. And, you know, the judges are clear on that. They, you know, some of the first judges to respond to this said this is so clearly unconstitutional and illegal that they just put a freeze on the orders entirely. But it takes some background knowledge to know that. And so at this point, my default assumption is that these orders are illegal. And, I would encourage people to assume that most of this is illegal, and ask about that, you know. Because we are. Trump is just taking permission to wildly overreach presidential constitutional powers and try to grab congressional powers.
Yeah.
And Congress should be pushing back on that. Congress shouldn't be letting the president take their power either. So, remind your congressperson that the power of the purse sits with them.
So the Democrats are certainly questioning all of this, but the Republicans so far have held ranks. Do you have any thought what's going to be the straw that broke the camel's back for them and that the Republicans will start pushing back as well?
I think Republicans intended for this. I think this is what they wanted. And, they've been talking about it for a long time. So the legal community, we see it in court. I've seen it for years. And so they're sort of bottomless in what they'll accept. And I know people don't like partisanship, but from a legal perspective, they're going along with this. This is what they wanted. And it's what they're support. They're continuing to support the president and issuing all these executive orders. They are carried away with doing it under a DEI sort of smokescreen. They just issued a list of keywords, including the word women, that are now banned for National Science Foundation grants. So, if there are people who have within the Republican Party who think that this has gone way too far, they should speak up. But I think they have a way too broad of a tolerance for constitutional abuse, and people are going to need to let if Republican voters are starting to say this is crossing a line, then they need to speak up. The Democratic Party doesn't have federal power at the moment. Well, they're a minority party at the moment, so it's going to take some Republicans stepping in to prevent some of this rolling downhill. And unfortunately, I don't necessarily have an answer. I do think the tolerance is way too high for constitutional abuse.
Yeah. You're here. wow. Well,
yeah.
Greenstein attempts to be positive, but we certainly have gotten into the dark side of subject. But I think it's real, and we need to face up to it. And there's lots of positive stuff that's going on. Last week's notes has a post from Catherine Hayhoe about all the stuff that corporations and private individuals and new technology is doing to help fix climate change, quite in spite of what the government's doing, and that it is the sensible way to go in the future to electrify and make things more efficient and to pay attention to emissions as well. And so even with the Project 25 having all the stops pulled out for dismantling the federal government and having it be a equal opportunity playing field for the oil companies, it's not without hope, because there is another side. We just have to be doing, that has to accelerate. That has to, climate change is accelerating, and the cures for climate change have to accelerate as well.
I mean, I think, in jiu-jitsu, there's a principle where you use your opponent's, momentum to,
Yes.
gauge your own moves, and it allows you to lift weights way beyond what you would think you can do. And I think we're going to have to do some of that and use these opportunities to meet new people and you know, I just met a new climate scientist this morning who's working on cloud modeling, who had some of their research canceled. Wow. And so now, you know, now, but now I know them and now I can ask them different questions. So every time you work on this, you know, also, yeah, try to make a new acquaintance, try to reach out to a new office. Try to think, I think one of the places where I'm getting my hope from is thinking normatively about what, when we do have an opportunity to try to fix some of this, how are we going to want it to be? And, you know, I think putting those questions into conversation in community, kind of taking a long-term view of like, what horizon do we want to try to reach for? And knowing that a lot of climate progress has been made. You know, the research has gotten so much clearer over the years. A lot of it is still available, open access. People can reach out for that. It's still available. It's still going to be available in other countries. Other countries are going to continue down their path of trying to figure out infrastructure and, you know, new technologies. We can also work. We can work at a local government and state government level to try to advance this stuff. And then also, you know, the economics of a lot of this have really changed. You know, solar and wind are a lot cheaper to build than other sources of energy. And there are tons of model laws. There's tons of case studies now. So the information is out there, and it is pretty grim what's happening to the federal government and the Constitution. But we also have a lot of points of agency, and we have done a lot of work to give ourselves certain advantages, and we just have to take what we have and keep carrying it forward.
Yeah, keep working harder. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
well,
just build our way out of it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for turning the gloom and doom around a little bit at the end. But I think we have to recognize the saber-toothed tiger at the door of our cave and decide that we're going to actually galvanize into some kind of action.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be really important that we try to sort out and keep straight what's true from not what's not true.
Yeah.
And we have to do that in community and together and learn, like, how do we fend off, you know, how do we still discern truth amidst an information warfare?
Yep. Yeah. A lot of disinformation out there, but we try to keep the accurate information going here in GreenZine, and you've helped us a lot with that today, Lauren. So once again, thanks for joining us on GreenZine.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for what you do, for keeping it community-based and community-informed.
Okay, that's great.
That's where change happens from the bottom up.
Yep. All right, you have a good day
Thank
out in
you.
The snow.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Hey, Henry, we've just got about, almost 5 minutes left in the show. I want to just get to a reminder, a couple of local items here. Tomorrow, the Tunbridge Conservation Commission will be hosting our guest from last week, one of our guests from last week, and that is Emily Ruff, and she is the director of Sage Mountain Botanical Sanctuary up there near Orange, Vermont. And that is happening tomorrow at the Tunbridge Public Library at 7 p.m. And the title of her talk is Protecting Vermont's Ecosystem, Backyard Strategies for Corridor Conservation. And interesting, I'm going to shift over to this week's paper. A number of bills have been introduced by local legislators. And one of them that stood out to me, Senator White, this is Becca White, who represents in Windsor County. She has introduced Senate Bill 38, which directs the Secretary of Natural Resources to establish a program to fund habitat corridors and wildlife crossings across the state of Vermont. So some action at least happening positively here on the state level.
Yes, we need that. And the Scott administration and the enhanced representation of Republicans who've come into the state House and Senate are, or at least at least the governor is trying to roll back and make meeting the Paris Climate Accords not something the state can be held accountable for. Right. And he's saying, well, I think it's just a little too hard, so we'll just do this later. And we need to push back on that one.
Yeah, some timelines on existing legislation that has been passed, that actually is law. There are efforts to sort of defang, to override those bills that were passed in the last term. Hey, moving on here. There's a recent email from Bill McKibben. I don't have that one specifically in front, but he represents, well, a lot of things in the environmental world. But he has started a group called Third Act. So if you just put THIRDACT.org, you can get caught up on a lot of information. This is aimed at Vermont residents that are, well, maybe it's national, but particularly Vermont, that are 60 and over. And you can really find out what's up with them with a virtual meeting. There's a series of them, and the first one is coming up on February the 10th. Welcome to Third Act. Let's get started. You can register as a volunteer and learn about campaigns, working groups, and how you can plug into our growing network. I know they're planning some major actions later in 2025. So that first date is coming up 7:30 Eastern Time on the 10th of February. Once again, that website is thirdact.org. Back to you, Henry.
I have that down in my calendar as 7 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay.
So
On the 10th?
You're right. This is February 20th.
Yeah, there's one that's later on. There's okay. A series of them. But the one that's coming up in the nearest period is on February the 10th. So that's okay. That's pretty soon, 7:30 Eastern time.
Super. Glad you caught me up on my calendar.
Yeah, that's all right. Hey, real quick while it's in front of me, and this is a little bit further down the road, of course, our good friends down at Sustainable Woodstock, and I'd like to read a little bit of their mission statement. We exist to lead our communities through the climate emergency, empowering Woodstock and the rest of the Upper Valley to meet climate commitments and live sustainably through advocacy, education, and collaboration, kind of like what we try to do with this radio show. They have a green drink series. They're not doing one of those until March 1st, but their next film that you can see for free virtually is called Food and Country, all about America's policy of producing cheap food at all costs, which has long hobbled small independent farmers. Once again, that's coming up on February 26th. Henry, we're into our final minute.
Yeah, and we attempted to get a legislator on or someone who is savvy about the climate legislation going on in Vermont for our guest this week, and we will try again for that next week. And probably the following week we will have David Johnson on to talk about ways of dealing with soil that actually pulls carbon down, cools the planet, and it makes farming more profitable. It's a triple win, and it's something that doesn't take a lot of government dollars to make happen.
I like to hear that. Hey, we want to thank our underwriters right before Democracy comes on now at noon, Monday through Friday. Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit. Henry, we'll see you next week.
See you next week.